Why do I have so many Ferraris? I get so sick of deciding which one to drive that on Tuesdays and Thursdays I just drive an ordinary car. So if any of you students saw me pull up in the parking lot in a Toyota Camry, that explains that. Convincingly. Very convincingly. Now we're getting into the time after World War I, with the Great Depression, things like that. We'll be covering the American economy basically up to the present, and then we'll jump back and talk about the wars America has had, World War II and so forth. So we'll go forward all the way with the economy, and we'll come back, go forward all the way with the wars we've had, and then we'll be all caught up. Now, how does the American economy work? How do all economies work? Well, frankly, how does everything work? All things are cyclical. Whether it's the weather, human nature, eating whatever we want, whatever it is, everything is cyclical. We have our good days, our bad days. We have good weather, bad weather, everything like that. Now, with these cycles, you have up and down, up and down. I knew a person who was both a waiter and a chef at Longhorn Steakhouse. Now, as a waiter, he would get paid better than when he was a chef. So he would do both, either or. But he chose to be a chef instead of a waiter, even though it was less money overall. The reason was, it was more stability. Being a waiter was way too cyclical. Yes, he'd have good days, then other days would be bad, other weeks would be bad, and he still had those bills he had to pay. So he, like everyone, we really need that stability and predictability, not these wild cycles up and down, especially because it tends to be the bigger the boom, the bigger the bust. I give you the example, a kid eating whatever they wanted, you know, they'll eat a lot of sugar, they'll eat a lot of candy, oh, that kid's happy, that's great. Keep giving them sugar. Eventually, they're going to crash. And the more you pump them up, the harder they're going to crash. So the economy is just like that. Therefore, if you imagine, let's say I'm drawing a line, wildly swinging up and down, on an upward trend, that's out of control. Too many highs and lows, and they're too extreme. Ideally, imagine I'm drawing a diagonal line upward, diagonal, that would be the ideal. Balanced, stable, even if it's not overall as good as the wildly fluctuating one, still, you want that stability. Now the thing is, you cannot achieve a perfectly stable line like that, a perfectly stable upward trend. It is impossible in pretty much anything. We can moderate it, we can balance it out, just like our good days and bad days and everything like that, but it's never going to be perfectly even. Therefore, we'll get a somewhat fluctuating line up and down on an upward trend. Not wild highs and lows, but just minimizing them so that they're moderated. Now, how on earth do we do that? What's going on? Well, because the economy is naturally highly cyclical, government policy should be counter-cyclical. That's what it's called, counter-cyclical. We're trying to flatten out these wild highs and also wild lows to balance them out, not make it so cyclical. Now, the next question is, how on earth does the government do that? Well, what the government does is, it uses money to moderate the economy. See, whenever there's a problem with the economy, it's usually because of the amount of money in circulation, and usually there is too little money in circulation. Money is like oil for an engine. The car will still run with too little oil in the engine, but it won't run very well. It's going to break down, it's going to overheat, there's going to be problems. Same thing with blood in a human body. If you have too little blood, yes, you can still, well, let's say you've lost a lot of blood or you just had a donated blood, something like that, you're going to be much weaker. You'll still function, perhaps, or maybe you'll faint, maybe you'll collapse, but you won't necessarily die, but you'll perform much, much more poorly if there is a right amount of blood in your system. Money is like the lifeblood of an economy. Now, since the government can't just tell the economy to behave in a certain way, especially in capitalism, but really in any economy, the government cannot just control the economy and tell it what to do directly. But I've just explained that the economy is heavily influenced by money in circulation. The government can control money. It creates the money, for God's sakes. So, even though the government cannot control the economy directly, it controls the money, which controls the economy, and therefore it indirectly controls the economy through money. And here are the two methods the government uses to control the economy. And usually these would be in-class terms, counter-cyclical, and these next two I'm giving you, but they're not. I'm not giving you any in-class terms for the final exam. Fiscal policy is one method, and this is government use of its revenue collection and expenditure, which is taxing and spending, to influence the country's economy. Government's use of its revenue collection and expenditure, in other words, revenue collection usually means taxing, because that's where the government gets its revenue from. It collects taxes. And expenditure, which means spending of the government, to influence the country's economy. That's fiscal policy. That's one way the government controls it. The other way is monetary policy, which is government control of the size and rate of growth of the total money supply. And it's by indirectly affecting interest rates. So, and this is this monetary policy, which we'll talk about a little later, but government control of the size and rate of growth of the total money supply. This is usually done through a country's central bank, which in America is the Federal Reserve banking system, but it's called the Fed for short. So the Federal Reserve Banking System, or the Federal Reserve, or the Fed, is how it's usually referred to. That's what handles the monetary policy, which we'll talk about a little later. And it may be either expansionary, which means it's trying to grow the economy, or contractionary, which means it's trying to shrink the economy. Now, why on earth would it be trying to shrink the economy? Because, as I said before, the bigger the boom, the bigger the bust. So if you just keep pumping it up over and over and over again, you're guaranteeing there's going to be a huge collapse. So, where does government get the money for these things? How does government get its money? Well, when times are bad, the government needs to inject money into the economy, and the way they get it is the same way we get it. What happens is, if you've heard the saying, save some money for a rainy day, basically put money away for when times are bad. Now, like a lot of people, maybe you've heard the phrase, champagne tastes on a beer budget. That means that someone spends a lot more than they actually take in. They have expensive tastes, which they can't afford. Here in our country, we have always, rather than building up surpluses, we have always run deficits. Now, the next two in-class terms I usually give, which are not in-class terms for you guys, national deficit and a national debt. And I ask people, what is the difference? What is the debt and the national debt and the national deficit? And almost never does anyone know. Very rarely, very, very rarely do people know, and I don't blame them. Sound very similar, but now you're going to know. The national deficit, D-E-F-I-C-I-T, is the shortage between what the government takes in and what it spends within a given year. Shortage between what the government takes in and what it spends within a given year. National debt is the total money owed by the government. Basically, all former years of deficits and surpluses put together. Now, I use that term surpluses loosely because we don't run surpluses, very rarely. It happened 1 year under Bill Clinton, for example, which was many years ago. And it was a small surplus, and that's because the economy was really, really booming, and Bill Clinton cut spending massively, probably too much in the military, and so we had a small surplus. But usually, we're always running a deficit. Even before our country was founded, we were in debt, funding the Revolutionary War, and pretty much every year after that, just borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. Now, before we go on with this, to understand this issue, deficit, shortage between what's taken in and what's spent within a given year. Let's say any of you. Let's say somebody's working we got the guy in McDonald's there. Let's use that again. Let's say someone's working at McDonald's, making, let's use a round number. Let's say $500 a week. Let's use that round number. This person spends $600 in that week. So first week of working, he makes $500, spends $600. Does the person have a deficit? Yes, they do. How much is it? $100, because it's a shortage between what was taken in and what was spent. Next question, does the person have a debt? Well, it's a trick question. The person, he or she, might not have a debt if they had savings. Then they could have paid the extra $100 out of savings. But as I say, we are constantly, constantly running deficits. And it's easy to understand why this is. Our country is run by politicians who get voted into power. Now, when times are bad, the government is supposed to inject money into the economy by lowering taxes and raising spending. And can you see how this controls money? So now we're not talking about monetary policy yet, just fiscal policy. And fiscal policy is government taxing and spending. And either one of those, taxing or spending, can you see how when the government lowers your taxes, there's more money in the economy? When government raises spending, it's spending on bridges, roads, libraries, whatever it is, that's putting more money into the economy. And by the way, it's interesting the way that works, because back in the Great Recession, when we had these problems, which I'll bring up the Great Recession again. This was around 2008. Okay, you guys were alive at that time. The economy was going really, really badly. Now, tax cuts, that's great. That's going to be more money left in the economy. The problem with that is, and by the way, it's fast too. You want something fast when there's a problem, just like when you have an injury or some medical problem or whatever the problem is, the faster you can get the solution, the better it's going to be. And you can get these tax cuts working really, really fast by basically giving payroll tax cuts. Those of you who work, which is most of you, when you get your paycheck at the end of the week, you see one number, which is what you earned, and a smaller number, which is what you actually get to keep. Now, if the government said, okay, we're not taking anything this next month, immediately that money is in people's pockets, ready to spend, and so there's more money in the economy. But there's a problem with just cutting taxes. It's fast, it's easy, everything like that. But when times are bad, when people are afraid of losing their jobs, things like that, they get the money, but they're not going to go out and spend it. They're going to keep it because they don't know if they'll be out of a job next week or tomorrow. So they need to hold on to as much money as possible. And I said, money is like oil for an engine. Well, to extend the analogy even further, that oil is only effective when it's actually in the engine. If you have that oil in your car, but it's in the glove compartment, that's not going to help that engine. If people have that money, but they're not spending it, it's not circulating in the economy, it's not going to help the economy. So, there's also government spending. Now, that has the advantage of really definitely getting the money into the economy, because when the government, let's say, updates Miami International Airport, which is long overdue, but let's say they spend $1 billion on that or something like that, that money is definitely going into the economy. It's buying supplies, hiring workers, everything like that. And those workers, by the way, are going to spend that money because they know, oh, the government's hired me. I'm going to have a job for at least a year and a half. But who knows what will happen after that, but at least for the foreseeable future, for the as far in the future as we can see, I'll have a job. And therefore, they'll go out and they'll spend the money, and it will circulate in the economy. The problem with spending is it takes a long time to get anything done. It takes a long, long time to get, even if something is decided. Yeah. Firstly, who's to decide what the money is going to be spent on? Some people will say roads. Some people will say libraries. Some people will say a high-speed rail. And then once they decide that stuff, okay, where is that library going to go? Who gets the library? All the people want it. What about the high-speed rail? You know, a lot of people want it, and a lot of people don't. They don't want it going near their neighborhood or anything like that. So there's a lot to be decided. And then once it's decided, location, everything like that, well, what are the specifics that we're getting into here? How will it look? What is the environmental impact of it? What kind of studies do we need? What land do we need to buy to build upon? And will these people sell it? You know, all these things, there's a lot that has to be architectural plans, everything like that. So it's a good way to do things, but it's a very slow way to do things. Unlike taxing increases or cuts, spending increases and cuts are very difficult. But here, it's the same thing. I was explaining why we are constantly running deficits and everything like that. You see, our country is run by politicians. They depend on people voting for them. Now, when times are bad, you inject money into the economy by cutting taxes and raising spending. Government spends more on whatever it is. Well, people like that. Okay, government's cutting my taxes. That's good. Government's spending more on me. It's building museums here. It's building libraries, whatever it is. That's good. Let's vote for these politicians. So when the government cuts taxes, which means it's getting less money in, and when it raises spending, which means there's more money going out, that means it has to get the money from somewhere. It has to borrow, unless it has savings, which it obviously doesn't. Then what about when times are good? You see, that's when the government is supposed to clamp down on things and pursue a contractionary policy, contract the economy, raise taxes, which takes money out of the economy and cools it down. Lower spending, which takes out of the money out of the economy and cools it down. This is what the government is supposed to do when things start to go well. But politicians don't get reelected by raising people's taxes and by cutting spending on things that the people wanted. So when times are good, the politicians don't do this part of things. In fact, they even do worse things. They keep cutting taxes. They lower taxes even when times are good. They raise spending even when times are good, which superheats the economy and makes it boom and boom and boom. And as I said, the bigger the boom, the bigger the bust. Part of the reason we're having so much trouble right now is because these politicians in the past, instead of doing what they needed to when times were going well, they did the worst possible thing. Instead of making a counter-cyclical policy, they made the economy even more cyclical. They pumped it up. Our current president, Donald Trump, he issued huge tax cuts when the economy was near its peak. And that made it go even higher, made the stock market go even higher, everything like that. But the bigger the boom, the bigger the bust. And then, of course, obviously, when there is a bust, we don't have the money that we needed to. Remember, save something for a rainy day? Well, they're not saving anything. They're lowering the taxes when times are good. It's not just President Trump. Bill Clinton did it. George W. Bush did it. I don't know that Barack Obama did it to a large extent, but this is what government tends to do. Now, here's another big question, very big question. We have these deficits and everything like that that we keep running, and it adds up. We get a national debt. National debt is a total money owed by the government. Okay, I said that. Now, how much money do we owe? And well, you're listening at home or whatever it is, guess how much money we owe. How much is our national debt? It is over $27 trillion. Over $27 trillion. That's trillion with a T, dollars. And this year's deficit is record-breaking. You would have to go back way, way back, decades and decades before you got something, but this year's deficit is predicted to be approximately $4 trillion. Now, you may hear these numbers and everything like that, and it tends to blur together million, billion, trillion, kajillion, you know, whatever it is, and that's fine. But I read this really great example years and years ago. Excellent economist, I believe Niall Ferguson in his book. But anyway, he wrote about this being such a huge number, it's almost beyond human conception. And his example was what was going on where he was standing a trillion seconds ago. You tell, and I ask the class this when I'm in class, you know, I use this example. What was happening where I'm standing a trillion seconds ago? And people say, oh, well, you weren't standing there. Oh, you weren't, it was a year ago. Or the school wasn't built yet, something like that. Well, actually, a trillion seconds ago, no one on the planet could read or write. Because a trillion seconds is almost 32,000 years. Now, a second is like nothing. That was a second right there. A snap of a finger is a second. But when you put a trillion of those together, it's almost 32,000 years because it's such a gigantic number. And you don't owe a trillion seconds. You don't even owe $1 trillion. You owe over $27 trillion. And someday that debt is going to come due and somebody's going to have to pay it. And that somebody is you. So this is something to be really careful about because it seems like, oh, taxes are low and the government isn't taking money. They are taking the money. They're borrowing it and we'll have to pay it later on. And these are huge, huge amounts of money. Is there any good news? Well, there is. There is. A large portion of the money is owed to ourselves here in America. We, through various means, we buy U.S. savings bonds or whatever it is. And so the government actually owes a lot of that money to Americans. So that was, that's one benefit right there. By the way, the foreign country that owns the most amount of our debt, which is it? Some of you will guess it, but only recently would the answer be China. You would probably guess China and you'd be right, but through many, many years before that, it was Japan. China only recently overtook them because the Japanese save huge, huge amounts of money. It's actually a detriment to them. They save way, way too much money and don't spend enough, but that's what it is. And some of you may be wondering, how does a national debt work? How do other countries borrow from us? Well, say Saudi Arabia, okay, let's say last year they had an extra $75 billion left over. Now, Saudi Arabia has been doing kind of poorly from some bad decisions its leaders made, but let's just assume they had that money. What are they going to do with it? Keep it under a mattress? No, they want some return on that, especially because there's inflation, which I will talk about, where the money becomes worth less and less. So even if you're not doing anything with the money, not spending it or anything like that, you're still losing, because as there's more inflation every year, the money becomes worth less. So you're trying to make some money just to stay even. And I haven't explained inflation yet, but I will. So what is Saudi Arabia going to do? Well, it doesn't want to risk this money. It doesn't want to get into some wild scheme or whatever it is. If there's business to be done or anything like that, it will do it itself. With this money that's saved, they want to keep it someplace safe. And there is no safer investment on earth than U.S. government treasury securities. Treasury securities, basically, it's like a bond or something like that. Other countries, they will lend us this money, and it will be a very low interest rate, because another principle of business and usually in life itself, risk equals return. Risk equals return. Because the U.S. government is such a secure investment, the whole country would have to fall apart and dissolve for that debt to be defaulted on. So because it's so secure, because there's so little risk, we don't need to give people much interest, because they're getting safety and security. The more risky the investment, the more you have to incentivize people with a higher interest rate. States have their own bonds. Cities have their own bonds. Corporations have their own bonds. And sometimes, like the city of Detroit, went bankrupt. They defaulted. Some countries have defaulted on what they owed, not the United States. We are very solid as an investment. And on top of that, this is a huge benefit to us. If you've ever heard the saying, it's good to be king, if you've ever heard that phrase, well, it is. It's good to be king. We owe this money in our own currency. The U.S. dollar is the standard currency of the world. It's the benchmark where things are matched against and everything like that. And so that's the money in which things are owed. And so we owe that debt in our own currency. And since we can create as much as we want of our currency, we'll never really be in danger of defaulting. Because if it came down to it, this over $27 trillion, we could make a $28 trillion bill and say, here, keep the change. And the people have to take it. They don't have a choice. Now, would they be happy with it? Probably not. But they would accept it and they would live with it. Now, why don't we do that? Why don't we just print more money? Now, here's another thing. I keep going off on these slight tangents here, just little things, kind of like pulling over to the side of the road just to explain some of these things. I just used the phrase printing money. Does the government print money? It does, but that's due to the Federal Reserve. That's due to the Treasury Department that prints the money, not the Federal Reserve. The actual creation of new money is done on a computer. Nothing is printed up. We really print money when we're retiring the old physical money, not to add new money. So in other words, we only print new $100 bills when there's some new anti-counterfeiting measure or whatever it is. We're not really adding money to the economy that way. We're just doing it because we need new paper currency. And that's another thing. It's not paper, it's cloth. If you've ever left some money in your pocket when you put it through the laundry, comes out just fine. Unlike other paper you might leave in your pocket, goes out into the laundry, it's ruined. But money is actually made on cloth, a type of cloth, cotton and linen, which is a type of cloth. I don't know the exact formula because it's classified. They don't want counterfeiters doing this. But anyway, so that's just a way of speaking. When you see on the news the government is just printing money and doing this and that, really, when it's adding new money, it's something done on a computer, which the Federal Reserve does. It's no physical money. So why doesn't the government just do that? If it can print as much money as it wants, why doesn't it print more money? Because money is not wealth. Money represents wealth. If money was wealth, the government could just create twice as much money and make everybody twice as wealthy. But that's not how it works, as some of you know. If the government makes twice as much money, it just makes the money worth half as much. That's mainly the effect of what happens. That's really what inflation is. When you create more and more money, it becomes worth less and less and less. And then things become more expensive because the money is worth less. Before, you might be able to get that refrigerator for $1,000. If the government printed twice as much money, that fridge is now going to cost $2,000 because your money is only worth half of what it used to be. This is what happened after the end of World War I. If you recall, I explained the Treaty of Versailles and the war guilt clause, where Germany had to take the total blame for causing the war and had to sign basically a blank check. Yes, we owe you these damages. And later on, the British and French fill in the blank. It's $34 billion, approximately, that Germany had to pay. Now, that was an incredible amount of money back then. And the position that Germany is in after World War I, it doesn't have half $1 billion, let alone $34 billion. And the British and French will not let them slide. They want their payments. Everything. First payment comes due. The Germans are scraped the bottom of the barrel and they can come up with half of that first payment. The British and French say, all right, we'll take it. But next payment comes due. You better have that, all of it, plus what you owe from this, plus the interest, or we'll take another big chunk of Germany. Well, Germany knows it has to do something. And so it's printing presses for money. Back then, when they wanted more money, they didn't have computers, obviously, after World War I. That was actually physically printing more money to get more money. They run their money printing press 24 hours a day, nonstop. Just make more and more and more money. And of course, the money is becoming worth less and less and less and less. There were, the money became basically worthless. There were people paying for a loaf of bread in Germany with a wheelbarrow full of currency, which is called marks. We call our currency dollars. The Germans called their currency marks. And they would pay for a loaf of bread with a wheelbarrow full of cash. There's this famous anecdote. An American went to Germany, ordered a cup of coffee, liked it, and then he ordered another cup of coffee. When the bill came, it was more than he was expecting, and he questioned the waiter. I'm being overcharged here. The waiter said, no, that was the price of the original cup of coffee, but the price went up before you ordered your second cup. In the future, if you want two cups of coffee, I suggest you order them both at once. And that's what it is. That's not just inflation. That's a very specific thing called hyperinflation. Hyperinflation, where it just goes way out of control completely. It happened in Germany. It happened in a couple of African countries. It happened in Russia. In various places this has happened, and the money becomes basically worthless. And it helps people who owe money, because now that, let's say, $10,000 you owe is worth a lot less. It's easy to make. Wages have gone up. Everything has gone up, so that's good. But the people who have savings, people who saved and saved and saved, and now $10,000 will buy you a sandwich, because it's hyperinflation. It's worth so little. Those people are wiped out. And it devastated Germany. It devastated them with this hyperinflation. And it, in large part, contributed to the Germans going to war a second time and basically World War II. So, inflation also is closely linked with debt. You know, I just gave the example of personal debts and every somebody owes $10,000, but even government debt, where the government owes a lot of money and things like that, it affects interest rates. It's all connected. The whole economy is connected. And after World War I, the country was much deeper in debt. If you looked, by the way, this is a side note, but if you looked at a chart of all our country's deficits, every deficit we've ever had year by year, all on one chart, you would see it going slightly up every year it went up. But you would see it shoot way, way up for several years in a row, multiplying massively, massively more than it was before. And then it will level off again, still going up every year, but relatively level. And then after some time, you'd see it shoot way, way up for several years. And then it would level off again, meaning we're going deep, deep into both the national deficit and the national debt. Same years. If you were looking at a chart like that of our whole country's history, national deficits and national debts, what happened during those periods of a few years where it skyrocketed? During those few years, war. If you want to see when our country went to war, look at a chart of our national debt and deficits. You will see it skyrocketing during that time because wars are really, really expensive. Much more so than people realize because they know, I mean, wars tends not to be that popular with the people to begin with. And if you have to raise taxes a lot to pay for it, it's really going to be unpopular with the people. Therefore, what governments tend to do is borrow. They borrow a lot of money just so they can finance these wars. Now, currently, we have a bit of an exception. This year, it's a different problem with the coronavirus and everything like that. So we're borrowing a lot of money, the government's going to collect a lot less in taxes because so few people are working. And it's giving out so much money, stimulus packages and everything like that. So this is unusual that it's not because of war, but it's pretty bad. It's pretty bad, the deficit and debt. Now, to fully understand how this economy works, how any economy works, the American economy, everything like that, we have to go back in history. We see that the original form of economics was basically barter, B-A-R-T-E-R, B-A-R-T as in Tom, E-R, barter. You're trading one thing for another. You're trading stuff back and forth. But there are problems with this. There's a number of problems with barter. I mean, firstly, double coincidence of wants. What does that mean? A double coincidence of wants. When you have some transaction, there has to be a coincidence of wants. Somebody wants to buy the computer you're using. They have to want to buy it, and you have to want to sell it. There has to be a coincidence of wants. If somebody wants to barter for the computer you're using, there has to be a double coincidence of wants. They have to want your computer, and you have to want to sell it. And then you have to want what they're trading for it. And they have to be willing to give it up. They have to want to give it up. So that's problematic. Then there's a lot of reasons, and we're not going to spend too much time on this, but just for pure convenience, I mean, carrying it around, storing it. Let's say, you know, you're trading three goats for one cow. Imagine the difficulty of storing that. Moving it around to actually go to the trade and back and forth. And of course, what if they only want one of your goats? They have a cow worth three goats and you could do the trade, but they only want one of your goats. What are they supposed to do? Cut one third of their cow and give it to you? So barter has quite a few problems. Transportation, everything like that, that's got issues. After barter, what else was there? Well, there were precious metals, gold, silver, things like that. There were also precious stones, diamonds, rubies, emeralds, jewels, things like that. Now, carat, I really didn't want to get into this. It'll take too long. But, I mean, basically, gems are measured in carat as a measure of their weight. And that comes from these old carob seeds. See, gems are very small, obviously. And when you're weighing them, you need a standard that's also a standard of weight that's also very small. So it was fine if you're weighing meat or chickens or something like that that weigh several pounds or something. You can get that. It doesn't have to be exact. But when you're such a small item, like a sapphire or whatever it is, the little bits of weight difference actually make a big difference. And so how can you find something standardized weight? Well, these carob seeds are all, for whatever reason, roughly the same size and weight. Once you take out the very big and very small ones, they're all the same size and weight. So they're like Mother Nature's standard weights for small things. Those are carob seeds, and that became pronounced carrots. Nothing to do with the vegetable carrots. So carrots are how you measure weight of gems, and they're how you measure purity of gold, except there it's spelled with a K. So 24 karat gold is pure gold, and then in America we usually only go as high as 18 karat because pure gold is very soft. It's not good to use as jewelry and everything like that. It's too soft. And gems, diamonds, for example, you have the four C's: cut, color, clarity, and karat weight. There you go. But anyway, you have all these different issues when it comes to, there's a lot that I'd like to get into. One thing I will mention, even though I should probably skip it, is, okay, you have this money, and where are you going to keep it? Where's the average person going to keep it? They have some money. It's not a pile of gold or jewels or whatever it is, but they have some money. Well, where are you going to keep it that will be safe? Okay, you have some sort of safe. Now, it's not some combination lock or whatever it is. It's like a jar which is holding your stuff, holding whatever money you have. What are you going to make it out of? Glass is not very safe, and also it would be incredibly expensive. Metal would be even more expensive. That's safe, but it's even more expensive. What will people use? Well, it's going to be something made out of ceramic, which comes from the mud and clay in the ground. That's what it is. And you make that, you put your stuff in it, your what little money you have and everything, and that's fine. Now, the word for this mud and everything was actually pig, P-Y-G-G, pig. And now, this may have been a coincidence, or it may have been because the animal rolls around in this mud and everything, but the animal, pig, P-I-G-G, it sounds exactly the same. Why do pigs roll around in the mud? Are they just filthy creatures? Some students sometimes know this. It's because they don't have sweat glands, and they do it to cool off. So firstly, that mud on them and everything is protection against the sun hitting them completely. And then also the wetness in the mud as it evaporates, just like we sweat, when it evaporates, that cools us down. Dogs, why do they always pant with their tongue out? Because they don't have sweat glands. And they need the water, the saliva, to evaporate off their tongue, taking the heat with it and cooling them down. So these pigs, they roll around them in the pig, which is this orange type of clay and everything like that, and that's fine. It is said that, you know, here in America, when people from the old country came here, you know, somebody ordered 24 pig banks, meaning basically that storage container is made out of pig, made out of that orange clay. And the person misunderstood. This is the story, okay? Person misunderstood and made these two dozen in the shape of pigs. And this really caught on as being something cute and whatever it is. Kind of like that Roosevelt teddy bear. But that's how piggy banks were invented. That's what they say. And moving forward into banking, modern banking anyway, what happens is modern banking really came out of medieval and early Renaissance Italy. So Italy, very ideally situated right in the middle of everything and ideal location in which to do business. That's fine. Now you need to borrow money and everything like that. And in Italy, these people who would lend money, they're not going to be indoors where nobody can see them. They're going to be in a public spot where everybody can see and come to them. Nice cool breeze, everything like that. So they're going to be out there in the parks, sitting on their benches. And the Italian word for bench is banco. Banco. And so when you need a loan, you go to the banco, the bank. That's where we get that from. And they would, if they agreed to lend you money, they would give you a letter of credit, except that letter of credit wouldn't be on paper. It would be on tiles. Italy is famous for making tiles and everything like that. And so you would have this tile which had your credit on it and everything like that. Now, just as if that money lender just lent out too much money or made bad investments and everything like that, and now they can't lend out any more money. They don't have any more. Their loans went bad, whatever it is. They're out of business. Their bench would be broken to show everybody, no, this person's out of business. They don't have any more money to lend. They're out completely. And the Italian word for broken bench is, the Italian term is bancarotti. What the word do we get from that? Bankrupt. Bankrupt. And I believe, same thing with that letter of credit, when you have your letter of credit and you're using it and everything like that, once it's been expended, they would break the tile. And that may be where the term broke comes from. When you have nothing left, you're broke. Now, that is the birth of modern banking, but banking has been around for a lot longer than that. Kind of like insurance. Insurance has been around for basically as far back as we know, way, way back. But modern insurance came up with the triangular trade, the slave trade, because that was the first time in really recorded history where you had so much money. The value of the slave trade was gigantic, and there was so much money involved that's when insurance really became modernized and professionalized and became what it is today. But it existed even before that. I mean, you were sending a wagon of goods 20 miles away. What if something happens to it? It gets robbed. It gets falls off a cliff, anything like that. You have always had insurance. Well, the same thing, you've always had banking. And the origin of banking is, we're talking about people with money here. The banking is not for people who are destitute and everything like that. It's people who actually have some money. And back then, way, way back, we're talking about gold. Whether it be coins or nuggets or whatever it is. Where are you going to store it? Well, you'd have to make a safe, not just out of pig or some material like that. You'd have to make a metal, not just out of metal either. It would have to be something very thick, heavy, impenetrable, and something so big and heavy it couldn't be moved. So someone couldn't just grab the whole thing and run off with it and work on breaking it open later. And that's going to be very difficult, very expensive, and very unnecessary for basically a relatively small amount of gold. Now, when you have gold, usually you're making it into rings or bracelets or necklaces or ears, something or another you're making it into. And for that, you need a goldsmith. Just like you have a blacksmith to make horseshoes or whatever it is, you have these goldsmiths that actually make this jewelry into whatever you need. Now, that goldsmith needs a safe to keep all this gold that he's working on. So rather than everybody making their own vault, their own safe, doesn't it make sense they just store it in the goldsmith's safe? Keep everything in one place. It does. And the goldsmith is happy to let you store your gold with him. But he's not doing that out of the goodness of his heart. He's doing that because he wants to make money. How is he going to make money? Well, what's happening is he is going to be allowed to lend out your gold, lend out your money, and charge an interest rate for it. And that's how he will make his money. Now, for your part, when you give that person the gold, you want some proof that you gave it to them. Just like at a pawn shop or whatever it is. But, you know, there was this old Simpsons episode long ago where Mr. Burns actually goes to Cuba with his $1 trillion bill. He has a $1 trillion bill. And he meets Fidel Castro. This is an old episode, as you might know. Boy, I feel older and older every year I teach class. Fidel Castro sees it and says, "May I see it?" Mr. Burns carefully gives it to him. And then Mr. Burns says, "Now give it back." And Fidel Castro is shown with his arms crossed. "Give what back?" And Mr. Burns is sailing back to America on a raft, minus his $1 trillion bill. So you want some proof that you gave your gold to this goldsmith. And the goldsmith will give you a receipt. Whatever it is, $100 worth of gold, whatever. And he will lend out your gold. Now, will he lend out all of it? No. Same principle. All this is true of modern banking as well. The goldsmith would like to lend out all of the money deposited with him because then he'll get interest on all the money. He'll make the most amount of money that way. But why can't he lend it all out? Because people are going to be coming in to get that money back. Not all of them, not all at once. That's why he can lend out a lot of it. But he has to hold some in reserve, maybe 20%, 30%, whatever it is, for the people who do come in and say, "Okay, now I'd like my gold back." So that's what it is, and people come in and they borrow this gold and whatever it is. Let's say it's 80% is being lent out. That's fine. What about you who actually deposited your gold? You have your receipt for $100 worth of gold, and then eventually a month later, 2 months later, you see a hut that you want to buy. You'd like to live there. And it's for $100 worth of gold. What do? You can either go all the way back to the goldsmith, collect your $100 worth of gold, come all the way back to the guy who owns the hut, give him the gold. Now, this is all risky, dangerous. You might get robbed, whatever it is. The person who's selling the hut has to test the gold, the weight, the purity, everything like that. And at the end of the day, he's probably going to go all the way back to the goldsmith and redeposit it to the goldsmith. What would be a much simpler way of doing things? You have your receipt for the gold, which is, it's literally as good as gold. You present it to them with your signature or whatever it is, and they'll give you your $100 worth of gold. Isn't it much simpler to just give this receipt, sign it over to this person who owns the hut, and then your transaction is complete? Much easier, much more efficient. Now, something very interesting has happened here. Very, very interesting that people didn't notice, but you're spending that $100 worth of gold through the gold receipt. But about 80% of that original gold has been lent out, and that's being spent as well. So without anyone intending to do this, what's happened is the money supply has almost doubled because of this method. Now, all this happens today as well. Today we call it fractional reserve banking, which means that when you deposit X amount of money, it actually winds up being much, much more than that. There's way, way more money in circulation than the government ever put out there because of its multiplier effect. Banks, same thing when it's controlled. This is monetary policy, but they have their own reserve requirement, how much they can lend out. They have, you know, all these types of things, which I'll talk to you about, but the principles are exactly the same. Now, to get around this idea of constantly having to test gold and silver and how much is in there and what is the level of purity and everything like that, human beings invented coins. You made these silver or gold or whatever it is into a coin with a design and everything like that, not easily copied by a layman. It can only be done by the government, really, or the king or whoever it is. And therefore, people know, okay, this coin is worth this much. An important invention. But what would happen is, these human beings are always going to be devious and try and find some scam or whatever it is. There's something called coin clipping, which means that when you got a gold coin, you would shave the end off just a little bit, almost unnoticeable, and then you'd pass it on. And you'd keep doing that over and over and over again, and at the end of a year, you might have enough shavings to make a whole new coin. Not that you needed it in a coin. The gold shavings alone are enough. So this kept going on, and people kept shaving the coins down. Even when it was noticeable that it was shaved, hell, who's going to miss a little more? So shave a little bit more. And so they invented something called milling or reeding, R-E-E-D-I-N-G, and that's putting edges, putting these nicks on the edges of the coin. And that's why if you look at your dimes and your quarters and your $1 coins like that, they have those ridges on the ends of them. It was to prevent coin clipping. Because our money was originally made out of, by law, you see our, let me take a step back. When our country was founded, our founding fathers, again, looked to history because all the answers are found there. And specifically, they looked to the ancient Greeks and Romans. And they saw, oh, what happened in Rome? Originally, the coins were pretty much pure. But then later emperors and everything like that, they needed more money, so they made more impurities in the coins. They diluted the value of the coins more and more and more. And by the end of the empire, the coins had almost no precious metals left in them. It's fluff. And this happened. Oh, so many lessons about life in these things. Just like anything you do a little bit at a time. You know, in meat, there was a scandal about the pink slime in the burgers, in the food. They kept adding more and more impurities. And in the 70s, the Egyptian bread riots, Egypt tried to restrict the food subsidies. They tried to save money by cutting food subsidies for the people. But there was massive rioting. So they brought the food subsidies back up to normal. But they slowly started adding impurities to their bread more and more and more, and people didn't notice then. There's an old saying, you know, boiling a frog in oil, in water. If you put a frog in boiling water, it's going to jump out immediately. It's going to feel it. But if you put a frog in water and slowly turn up the temperature in the oven more and more and more slowly, the frog won't notice that it's heating up. And eventually it'll just die without ever noticing what's going on. It works. I've tried it. No, I haven't tried it. It's, you guys have too low an opinion of me. It wasn't a frog I boiled. It was a hitchhiker. I'm kidding. Okay, now, with our currency, they didn't want that happening. They didn't want these little by little by little out of that, so they made a law. It must be gold, our coins must be either gold, silver, or copper, and that is it. No other stuff. So what happens is that, and it's a certain percentage, because for example, you can't really make it out of pure silver, tarnishes easily and everything like that. So it's about 90%. I don't remember the exact number. It may have been exactly 90%, but here, gold, silver, or copper. That's what we make our coins from. And if you've ever wondered why the 5-cent piece is bigger than the dime, you know, I go into this a lot when we're in class. I can show you why every feature of the dollar is what it is with the pyramid and everything like that. But just generally here, because this is going to an important term called fiat money. What happens is, okay, they mandated this is what you need to make. You had the $20 gold eagle. That's fine. Then you have the silver dollar coin, and cent is short for percent. So that's what it is. So the 25-cent piece has 25% of the gold in a $1 coin. A 10-cent piece has 10% of the gold of the silver in a $1 coin. But wait, look at how small and thin that dime had to be, that 10-cent piece had to have 10% of the silver in a dollar. A 5-cent piece would have to be half the size of a 10-cent piece, and that's way too small to make it out of silver. To make it out of gold, it would be like a speck of dust to be worth 5% of the dollar in gold would be like a speck. And copper, you see how big the 1-cent piece is. It would have to be five times that size to be worth what the 5% of the silver coin, 5% of that silver dollar in copper. Because here's the thing, you have to have, it's not like today, what we have is fiat money. Fiat money is worth nothing intrinsically. Doesn't have gold in it, doesn't have silver, and it cannot be exchanged for a fixed amount of something valuable. See, through most of history, they weren't like us. If somebody says, okay, I'm giving you $5 with these coins, those coins had better be worth $5, either in gold or silver, or somehow you could exchange it for something of value. So even our currency in the past, it was either of this precious metal, or the cash, the bills, would be exchangeable for a fixed amount of gold or silver because it was backed by gold or silver. Now, we went off the gold standard. Richard Nixon finally took us off. And it's no longer backed by anything except the government's word. And pretty much all the money in the world now is fiat money. But through most of history, they would look at us like we were nuts. What do you mean you're giving me $100? There better be $100 worth of gold and silver in this, or $100 worth of copper, because copper was valuable as well. Or I'm not accepting it. And that's why all our money had to be in that, because some valuable metals. And so there had to be 5 cents worth of metal in that 5-cent piece. But you can't make it out of silver, it's too small. You can't make it out of 5 cents worth of gold, is way too small. And 5 cents worth of copper is way too big. Although the coin sizes have changed a little bit over time. But that's what it is. So what did we do? We eventually had to make a law. You can also make coins out of nickel, out of the metal nickel. And that's what we made the 5-cent piece out of, and that's 5 cents worth of nickel. But it wound up being bigger than the dime, even though it's worth half as much. And that's why we call it nickel, a nickel, by the way. And we call a dime that, because of dixme, is this French word for tithe, where you give up 10% of what you have. So there's always reasons for everything. There's a reason why Lincoln's head faces the other direction from all the other presidents on the coins. And it's not because of these silly stories, he got shot in the back of the head, so he doesn't want to turn his back on the other presidents or anything like that. It was just copied off a plaque, and that's the direction that Lincoln's head was facing. Now, more that we could say, but let's move on with this thing. Now, I mentioned I would explain monetary policy, and we'll do that now. Real quick, we had the government wants the economy to do well. Definitely. Politicians want to get reelected. Government wants to collect more taxes, everything like that. So government wants the economy to do well. Business wants the economy to do well. Banks, everything like that, they want the economy to do well so they can make more money. So doesn't it make sense to create some sort of institution to coordinate those two factors, the government and business, specifically banks? Well, that would be a central bank. And in our country, we currently have the Federal Reserve banking system. We had a central bank before that, but you don't need to know about it. That's nothing. So the Federal Reserve banking system and your bank where you do business is almost certainly a member of the Federal Reserve banking system. You get all kinds of privileges and benefits if you are a bank that's part of this system, because the government wants you to be a part of it. So Wells Fargo, Bank of America, all these different Chase, every bank you can see, you get they are part of this Federal Reserve banking system. And the Federal Reserve, as I said earlier, is what controls monetary policy, the quantity of money in circulation. So fiscal policy is really a fixed quantity, and the government is moving stuff around through taxing and spending. It's like a fixed pie, and it's cutting bigger or smaller pieces of the pie. Monetary policy is where you're changing the size of the pie, either making a bigger pie or a smaller one, depending on your needs. Enlarging the quantity of money in circulation heats up the economy. As I said, more money injected into the economy. If you shrink it, that's cooling down the economy. It's a contractionary policy. So what happens here is the government creates this Federal Reserve banking system, and it does so because there were various problems coming up in the economy. Bank runs and banks going under and whatever it is. So it creates this institution. And even today, as I say, if you go in there, you're going to see your money is insured. FDIC is a type of insurance up to a certain amount. It was $100,000 for a long, long time. But during the Great Recession, they increased it to $250,000. So if you had your money, your money that's in that bank, anything happens to it, it gets robbed. It gets blown up. It gets burned to the ground. Hackers wipe it out completely. Your money is insured, and the government will give it to you. So this is good. There are other benefits as well for a bank to be a member of this Federal Reserve banking system, but there are also requirements and responsibilities. The Federal Reserve is able to do monetary policy, control the amount of money in the economy through these banks, and through three specific methods, three specific things in this banking. First, you have reserve requirement. The reserve requirement. Remember I said the goldsmith would like to lend out all the gold deposited with him, but he can't, because people will come in asking for their money, and he better have it to give them. Here, it's the same thing with the banks. They need to hold. Now, the Federal Reserve will decide the reserve requirement for these banks. The banks would anyway need to hold some back for people coming in and everything like that. But the Federal Reserve will tell them what that reserve requirement is going to be. They will set it high if they want less money in the economy. They will set it low if they want more money in the economy. And right now, the Federal Reserve has set the reserve requirement at 10%. So banks only have to hold 10% of people's money on hand and can lend out the other 90%. That's quite good. It's going to keep the economy moving over again, heating up more and more. And the thing is, this reserve requirement is kind of unwieldy as a tool. So the Federal Reserve doesn't manipulate it that often. In other words, it's been 10% for a long, long time, and the Federal Reserve doesn't usually change it, even though it could. That's one of its tools. And you can understand, if it raised the reserve requirement, that means banks are holding more money, and that means there's less money in circulation. But as I said, the Fed doesn't mess with this very much, especially because this would be a policy change, and every time they do that, the banks have to spend money to adjust to this policy change. So that's not really done. You see, the next thing of the three is the federal funds rate. You see, just like, and these principles apply in everything, just like if you're buying stuff, when you buy in bulk, you save money. When you borrow money in bulk, you save money. There's what's called a prime rate, which is, okay, if you have good credit and everything like that, you get a good rate on your loan. But if you get a prime rate, that's because you're borrowing so much money, let's say $20 million, to open a strip mall, something like that. Then, because you're borrowing so much, you'll get a special rate that's really, really low. Just like a prime cut of meat is a good cut of meat. That's the prime rate. There's a better rate than that called a discount rate. Now, that rate is not available to an average person. It is the rate that the Federal Reserve will lend short-term loans to its member banks. So that's another privilege of being in the Federal Reserve banking system. You can borrow money from the Federal Reserve at very low rates for short-term loans. Much better rate than any of us could get. Why do these banks need to borrow the money? Because they're lending out as much as they can and getting as close to that 10% rate as possible. At the end of the day, they must have 10%. The Federal Reserve checks it to make sure it's not being reckless. Each bank must have 10% held in reserve. And since the banks get so close to that 10%, they usually wind up, a lot of times they go over and they're a little bit short. Well, they just borrow it and then they're back to the 10% before the close of business that day. Because it has to be at the end of every business day they have it. Now, they can borrow from the Federal Reserve at this really good rate. But there's an even lower rate than that called the federal funds rate. And that's the means that the Fed really manipulates. It's the interest rate, which is set by the Fed, that member banks charge each other for loans from their excess reserves. What on earth am I talking about? Well, just like you might have lent out your member bank, say Chase, lent out a little too much money. Some other member bank, Bank of America, let's say, didn't lend out all its money. It came close to its 10%, but it didn't go under. So it has excess reserves. It can lend out that money to the other bank that has too little. And that's at the federal funds rate. These are short-term loans. These are like overnight or whatever it is. And it's a very, very low rate. And that federal funds rate is what determines all the other interest rates. They're basically based on the federal funds rate. They use that as a benchmark. And so you can see if the Fed puts that rate high, then other rates are going to be high. If the Fed puts that rate really low, then all the other rates can be low. Basically, if a bank is borrowing the money at 2%, it has to charge you considerably higher than that to make its money. Let's say it's borrowing it at 5%. It's not going to charge you 6 or 7%. It has to charge you 10 or 12%, something like that, to make a profit. But if the Fed sets the amount really low, as I said, then it can give you money at a very low rate. Guess what the federal funds rate is now and has been for a long time? It's between 0.25% interest. During the Great Recession, which I'll keep talking, I'll bring it up in the second part of this lecture. You know, we're coming up to our, I'm going to take you all the way to modern times. What happened is times we were really concerned and really scared. So the federal government dropped the federal funds rate to almost zero, between 0.25%. It got to the point where banks were borrowing this money at practically zero, basically 0%, and then buying treasury securities. So borrowing money from the government at practically zero and lending it back to the government at 1% interest or whatever it was. It's crazy, crazy, but that's what it was. And the third and last way, the most common way that the Federal Reserve handles monetary policy is through what's called open market operations. Open market operations. Now, you don't really need to go into this and really understand it. You're not going to be economists or whatever it is, but this is the most common way the Fed uses to control the money supply. Open market, because the Federal Reserve goes on the open market where anybody can buy and sell and everything like that. and conducts these operations, which are buying and selling of bonds, government bonds and everything like that. Now, how does this work? Basically, these bonds cannot be spent. If you bought a $1,000 bond from the government, you can't go buy something with that. It's certainly worth the money, but you can't spend it. So if the government decides to lower the interest rate really a lot or raise the interest rate, that will determine whether people want to buy or sell the bonds, whether they want to buy or sell the bonds, and the Fed, I mean. And so if it buys a lot of bonds that are out there, so it's issued all these bonds, it's done that, if it buys back these bonds, that's taking that illiquid asset, that's what it's called, that $1,000 bond. Forgive me, I'm trying to compress a really complex thing and simplify it here for you. But you have, let's say, bought this $1,000 bond. If the Fed sold it to you, that took $1,000 out of the economy. So the Fed might sell $100 million worth of bonds. That took $100 million out of the economy because people have these bonds which they can't spend until they mature at the end of 10 years or whatever it is. And the government has this money locked up. If it decides to buy the bonds that are out there, it buys, let's say, $10 million worth of bonds. It's going to be a lot more, but let's just say $10 million. That's taking these assets out of the economy which can't be spent and putting that $10 million into the economy which can be spent. So your $1,000 bond, when the Fed sold it to you, you gave $1,000 to the Fed, which is now no longer able to be spent. When the Fed buys it back from you, chooses to buy it back, it's giving you $1,000, and now you can spend it. So by buying bonds, it actually injects a lot of money into the economy. By selling bonds, it takes a bunch of money out of the economy. And that's how it's controlling the total amount of money in circulation. Now, this seems like a good place to break it, give you guys a chance to recover from finding out how much we owe in our national debt. And by the way, we still have a little bit of time, about a month left of 2020, so it's only going to go up. You'll actually find out the real amount we owe at the very end of this year. So, Merry Christmas in advance.